Today is Thursday, the 1st of October, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Fallout continues after the first U.S. presidential debate.
The kinds of things that we saw in the debate are exactly the kinds of things that erode democracy.
Plus, strategies to cope during the pandemic.
Don't underestimate the importance of being mindful to take care of your physical health, because your physical health impacts your mental health.
And the latest as fighting continues between Armenia and Azerbaijan. We'll have these stories and more next. The first U.S. presidential debate between President Donald Trump and Democratic nominee Joe Biden resembled more of a shouting match than a structured exchange of ideas. Debate organizers say they are working on changes to ensure a more productive discussion for the candidates' next encounter, but political analysts say the chaotic outcome of their first meeting is also a reflection of the country's deep political polarization. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Swara has the story.
Social media exploded with memes during the first presidential debate between President Donald Trump and Democratic nominee Joe Biden, with many viewers characterizing it as childish and as old men yelling at each other.
This is a left-wing This is radical left.
Will you shut up, man?
There were plenty of personal insults.
Yeah, there's nothing smart about you, Joe. 47 years, you've done nothing.
Listen, you're the worst president America has ever had. Come on.
Jennifer Mercia is a professor of political communications at Texas A&M University.
The kinds of things that we saw in the debate are exactly the kinds of things that erode democracy, that in fact our democracy is at risk. And you can tell by the way that political leaders talk to one another.
Discussions about the pandemic, economic recovery, and racial unrest were drowned out by insults and interruptions and shocking moments such as when the president refused to denounce white supremacists.
Proud Boys.
Stand back and stand by.
Our streets!
Proud Boys, a far-right group that engages in political violence, celebrated the president's remarks and created online memes with his answer. On Wednesday, Trump said he does not know who they are.
Over 200,000 dead, 14 million jobs lost, and Donald Trump spent an entire debate blaming others.
The Biden campaign launched a post-debate digital ad blitz highlighting Trump's remarks. While the Trump campaign claimed that the moderator and the media treated Trump unfairly in the debate and that Biden is weak. Tim Murtaugh is the director of communications for the Trump re-election campaign.
Joe Biden, who was put on his heels most of the time, spent a lot of time looking around for assistance from the moderator and sort of looking around for someone to bail him out.
Initial polls show that the chaotic debate did little to sway voters.
It was very disappointing for American democracy and the country as a whole. It was embarrassing, to be honest with you.
As campaigning enters its final weeks, both campaigns are trying to find voters they can still win over in the key swing states seen as most likely to affect the results. The remaining two presidential debates and one vice presidential debate are scheduled in October. Patsy Whitaker-Swara, VOA News.
Speaking to reporters on Thursday, U.S. Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany said the president repeatedly denounced racism.
This has been answered yesterday by the president himself, the day before by the president himself on the debate stage. The president was asked this. He said, sure, three times. Yesterday, he was point blank asked, do you denounce white supremacy? And he said, I've always denounced any form of that.
An estimated 9 million Americans live abroad, and 500,000 of them live in Israel, where observers expect an unprecedented number will cast absentee ballots in the upcoming U.S. presidential election. Linda Gradstein has that story.
U.S. President Donald Trump is popular in Israel for moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, for legalizing Jewish settlements in the West Bank, and most recently for facilitating peace agreements between Israel and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. Some American voters here say that's what sealed their choice.
His ears have been open to Jewish people and to hearing about Israel and being there for Israel.
But other voters on the left say President Trump has derailed any chance of a peace deal with the Palestinians.
First of all, I also don't see Israeli politics as benefiting from Trump's
refusal to engage with the Palestinians. So that defeats, you know, my sense of what needs to happen in Israeli politics. But I really do think that the United States' strength is something Israel relies upon, and the United States becomes less and less a powerful player the longer Trump is in charge.
Both Democratic and Republican expatriate groups say they've seen more interest in this election than any in recent memory.
We're seeing a huge wave of interest. Both before the lockdown, we were seeing a huge wave of interest on the streets. We do voter registration all around the country, and there's tremendous interest, growing numbers of members, fundraising, all of that is on the rise.
Republicans here believe their absentee ballots could make a difference in swing state results.
I'll tell you, in 2000, you know, when the presidency was decided by, what was it, 537 ballots from three southern Florida counties. In those very southern Florida counties in 2000, we had 1,200 Israeli absentee voters. And so therefore, if they hadn't voted for George Bush or whoever they voted for, then most of them voted for George Bush, he wouldn't have been president of the United States. Now, will that happen again in 2020? It's anybody's guess, but it could happen. Yeah. We have tens of thousands. We have probably between 20 to 30,000 Florida votes here in Israel alone.
This year's election on November 3rd is happening in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic, and officials in the United States are expecting a much higher than usual number of voters to cast absentee ballots at home and abroad. With an estimated 200,000 Americans in Israel eligible to vote in November, the absentee ballots from here could indeed make a difference. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Barbados announced last month that it intends to remove Britain's Queen Elizabeth as its head of state. Henry Ridgewell takes things from here.
Queen Elizabeth last visited Barbados on the eve of its independence from Britain in 1966. The island nation kept the monarch as head of state. However, opening a new session of Parliament last month, the Barbadian Governor-General, who represents the Queen but was speaking on the advice of the Prime Minister, said it was time, in her words, to fully leave the colonial past behind.
Barbadians want a Barbadian head of state. This is the ultimate statement of confidence in who we are and what we are capable of achieving. Hence, Barbados will take the next logical step towards full sovereignty and become a republic. By the time we celebrate our 55th anniversary of independence.
Changing domestic politics have led to such a move, says Commonwealth expert Philip Murphy.
There's been a growing consensus in Barbados behind moving towards a republic for about 20 years. The question is whether the ruling party has the constitutional mandate to do that. And the Barbados Labour Party now has that.
Britain's colonial past has come under the spotlight with the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, says the former Barbadian High Commissioner to Britain, Guy Hewitt, now a pastor in Florida.
This reassessing of our relationship with Britain as a former colonial power and with the royal family in terms of what has been their position on these issues.
Hewitt cites the so-called Windrush scandal as a turning point. After World War II, thousands of migrants came to Britain from its colonies in the Caribbean. In 2018, it emerged that hundreds were wrongly detained and denied basic rights. Dozens were deported back to the Caribbean, despite qualifying as British citizens.
We realised that the mother country, as Britain was affectionately known as, was not interested in the welfare and the well-being of people who had journeyed from the Caribbean, journeyed from Barbados, and helped build Britain in the post-World War II era.
The British monarchy says the future head of state is a matter for the people of Barbados. Tom Tugendhat, chair of the British Parliament's Foreign Affairs Select Committee, has blamed China for pressuring Barbados to remove the Queen as head of state. Beijing has invested heavily in the Caribbean in recent years. But many experts question his assertion.
I don't think China's the reason Barbados is changing who's going to be the head of state. I think the issues, you know, that China's role in the Caribbean is large. They have economic statecraft. They come with a large checkbook. But, you know, as one Barbadian ambassador said to me, when, you know, if nothing else fails, blame the Chinese.
16 Commonwealth nations still recognize the British monarch as head of state, including Barbados, which hopes to become a republic sometime next year. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Still to come on today's program.
So when you feel that fatigue, and it's important to say to yourself, what's the one thing that's possible that I can do to take care of myself?
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The inauguration of Belarus President Alexander Lukashenko following elections, widely viewed as being rigged, has ushered in a new scenario in Belarusian politics. The pressure against the authoritarian president has not diminished as the opposition pledges to continue its protests, while many countries refuse to recognize Lukashenko as the legitimate president of Belarus. In this report, narrated by Jonathan Speer, Ricardo Marquina has the details from Minsk.
Following an election very much in dispute, Alexander Lukashenko was sworn in for another term in an inauguration ceremony that was not announced. The reason for so much secrecy? To prevent tens of thousands of protesters from mobilizing and bringing the city to a standstill, as happened the Sunday after the inauguration. Now, among the protesters, the realization is starting to sink in that this is a battle for the long haul. Their hopes of forcing Lukashenko from power have collided with the tight control the longtime leader still has over Belarus' security apparatus. Still, the protesters are undeterred.
There will be some kind of dialogue, but I am sure that we will remove him from power because the country has risen against him and that is impossible to ignore.
Our only choice is to get more and more people to join us, to take our side, that people can make their choice, not a dictator, but the good people of Belarus.
The president has made it clear he will not engage in dialogue with the protesters. Instead, he insults them, calling them drug addicts, alcoholics, and rats. As those in power see it, the protesters are remotely controlled by foreign powers.
We can affirm without fear that Belarus is now, for the first time in its history, in a scenario of a color revolution, organized by foreign forces and coordinated by Lithuania and Poland.
The conflict between the opposition and Lukashenko is playing out on the global stage. Many Western countries refuse to recognize him as the legitimate president, while Russia supports him. But support from a powerful neighbor, analysts say, can also come with pressure and present questions of sovereignty for a small state like Belarus.
We have to ask a question. If we have such an imbalance, what is required from us by the Russian Federation? Complete obedience? To transform Belarus into a puppet or a protectorate instead of setting up a union with equal rights? That is the question.
For the protesters on the streets of Minsk, what has happened in the last several weeks is only the beginning of an unstoppable process.
Just 2 months ago, we could not imagine that this would happen, that so many people would take to the streets. That's why I think we should continue like this, go out onto the streets to show our disagreement.
A new stage of the conflict in Belarus is now beginning. On the one hand, the opposition will seek to erode Lukashenko's power with regular protests in the streets and with the help of international pressure. On the other, the government hopes that the work of its security forces, along with protester fatigue, may eventually cause the opposition's efforts to lose momentum. For Ricardo Marquina in Minsk, I'm John Speer, VOA News.
European Union leaders are seeking to end an impasse that prevents them from imposing sanctions on senior officials in Belarus. All 27 EU member countries agree on the sanctions, but Cyprus is vetoing the move because it wants the bloc to take action against Turkey for its energy exploration work in disputed waters off of its coast. French President Emmanuel Macron also told Vladimir Putin that the Belarusian opposition leader was open to dialogue and that the Russian president should talk to her. A statement from the French presidency said Putin and Macron shared the idea that the best way forward was mediation by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Belarus is a close ally of Russia, and Moscow has firmly backed veteran leader Lukashenko. Putin has spoken against outside interference in the Belarus crisis. The world has recently reached a tragic milestone of 1 million known deaths linked to COVID-19 and has nearly 34 million confirmed cases, according to statistics tabulated by the United States Johns Hopkins University. The pandemic has also created a stressful environment, compounded by the uncertainty of one's health, economic future, and more. VOA's David Byrd spoke via Skype to Claire Nikogosyan. She's a licensed clinical psychologist and clinical associate professor in the Department of Human Behavior and Clinical Psychiatry at the Brown University Medical School in Providence, Rhode Island. He began their conversation by asking her what strategies can be employed to address either helplessness or hopelessness.
Hope is something that is this feeling of at some point it's going to get better. But now we're into month 6, 7, depending on where you live, and maybe people don't feel that hope. They feel weary and they feel tired and they feel drained and confused and just overwhelmed, burdened. And what I encourage people to do is to consider what we're living through is one, extraordinary, and two, unprecedented. You know, different generations have had different hardships. This is a global hardship. And so understand that many of us are in survival mode and maybe haven't had experiences in our life to draw upon to get through this time. So it feels even more disorienting. And so what I find myself saying a lot is that every person has to take care of themselves. And that involves taking care of your physical health and your body. So, you know, those practical things that we need to access good coping skills. Are we getting enough sleep? Are we hydrating our bodies? Are we feeding ourselves nutritious food? Are we getting out and moving as often as possible in a safe way, you know, given our situations and where we may live? These are the important things that we can manage. We may not be able to manage other things outside of our home or in our communities, but how we take care of ourselves is so important right now. So I always say to people, you know, don't underestimate the importance of being mindful to take care of your physical health, because your physical health impacts your mental health. So the second practical thing that I find myself practicing myself and also encouraging clients is this is the time to set really good boundaries. And, you know, that is part of your emotional self-care.
It feels like there's a lot of pandemic fatigue, like people are just tired of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, if I get it, I don't care. I can't stand it anymore. I'm going to go do what I could do this time last year.
Mm-hmm.
And now, what do you recommend as far as when those feelings of I'm tired of it, I just want to get away from it, I just want to go be quote unquote normal again, kind of wash over you?
Sure, of course. So one, I would say know yourself, know what your limits are. And the next question I would, you know, ask this person is, have you gotten enough sleep? Are you hydrated? Have you had a meal today? Are we making decisions based on reactivity or responsiveness? And often when we make decisions out of reactivity, we're not really grounded. And of course, sometimes we have to make quick decisions. But, you know, when you're willing to take a risk and kind of throw your arms up and say the heck with it, right? It's important to kind of do a little inner reflection and say, is this reactivity or responsiveness? Is this something that's really going to be beneficial to me? Because one of the greatest epidemics we have, you know, globally is loneliness. And this was before COVID. I'm very concerned about mental health and loneliness.
Mm.
I'm very concerned, you know, living in Rhode Island and, you know, heading into the fall and the winter months here, very concerned about seasonal affective disorder, depression, substance dependence, domestic violence. You know, things can be overwhelming. And so we have to take care of ourselves and our families. And that's the place we can start. So when you feel that fatigue, and it's important to say to yourself, what's the one thing that's possible that I can do to take care of myself that will give me sustainable impact? You know, so meaning maybe a social event outside with people you trust, you'd reap the benefits for a week or two. Maybe a nice long hike, you'd reap the benefits. Maybe getting on a plane safely and going to see a relative that you haven't seen in, you know, 8 or 9 months. So I think that's the individual piece, is that we want to make decisions from a place of responsiveness, not reactivity.
Claire Nikogosyan is a licensed clinical psychologist and clinical associate professor at Brown University's Medical School. She was speaking via Skype to VOA's David Byrd. Intense fighting continued overnight between forces from Azerbaijan and Armenia over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. The fighting continued despite repeated calls for a ceasefire from around the globe. Russia has said that there is no alternative to using political and diplomatic methods to resolve the crisis. Turkey, a close ally of the mainly Muslim Azerbaijan, has said it will do what is necessary to support its government. French President Emmanuel Macron, whose country is home to about 600,000 people of Armenian origin, has accused Turkey of warlike rhetoric. The Secretary General of the Council of Europe released a statement calling for a peaceful solution to be found to avert a grave humanitarian crisis. According to officials in Nagorno-Karabakh, around 100 service members and several civilians on their side have been killed since the fighting erupted on Sunday. In addition, an Armenian government source told Reuters News that two French journalists working for the newspaper Le Monde are in grave condition after being shelled by Azeri forces in the Armenian town of Martuni. And you've been listening to International Edition of The Voice of America. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has long been a friend of the Association of Southeast Asian Nation Countries. Speaking by video at the annual U.S.-ASEAN Foreign Ministers meeting, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that our visions for the future of the Indo-Pacific is closely aligned. The United States is committed to ASEAN centrality in the Indo-Pacific and to supporting the prosperity of our ASEAN partners, he said. We are providing $89 million in assistance to fight COVID-19 in ASEAN countries, of the $20-plus billion that we have provided worldwide. We've delivered 850 ventilators to Indonesia, with another 150 expected to be delivered in the course of the next couple weeks, and 100 ventilators in the Philippines as promised as well. Secretary of State Pompeo announced a number of new initiatives designed to help ASEAN countries strengthen their sovereignty and growth.
First, we're pleased to adopt the ASEAN-U.S. Plan of Action for 2021 to 2025 to guide our future engagement together in line with ASEAN outlook on the Indo-Pacific. We're launching, too, the Mekong-U.S. Partnership to expand our engagement with the five countries of the Mekong region, a region of tremendous importance to ASEAN's prosperity and unity. We're proud to advance the U.S.-ASEAN Statement on Human Capital Development and back it up with new initiatives. The U.S. government intends to provide $5 million for the new Wysili Academy and Fulbright University, Vietnam.
That's in addition to over $13 million provided for programs under the U.S.-ASEAN Smart Cities Partnership to build productivity and improve people's lives. Finally, the United States has devoted new resources to help ASEAN countries face the current pandemic, as well as future ones.
The ASEAN Public Health Emergency Coordination System, through $1.5 million in funding from the State Department, will increase ASEAN's ability to respond as a region to emerging public health crises, and frankly, to help prevent the next pandemic, too. We've created a new Health Futures Alumni Network to share best practices in fighting and dealing with COVID. And our Department of Health and Human Services also plans to formalize its relationship with the ASEAN health sector.
I'm proud of America's work to support our friends in the ASEAN region, said Secretary Pompeo. You can count on it continuing.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.